Badlands. Explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
Hey, welcome everyone for this week's Breaking History. How you doing, Gordon?
I'm fantastic, Matt. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm all right. So I know that last week we went through a lot of deep history that I know a lot of people were really, really happy about. We got a lot of really positive feedback going through the untold history of the Crusades. What came before it? Why was it done? What were the occult agencies behind the rise of these orders, such as the Templars, that did a lot of damage to humanity? How did these things interact with other orders like the Knights of Malta, or the Knights Hospitaller, as they were called before they set up shop in Malta a little bit later on? How did that disrupt a lot of the flow of development of good things that were happening around the world before the Crusades? And today I know that we are going to deal with something that we alluded to indirectly, specifically the rise and the influence of a place that a lot of people might have been on their honeymoons, maybe on vacation, very, very scenic, romantic, images of gondoliers singing in Italian while lovers are sitting on a little canoe going through the little canals of Venice. But Venice is more than that. I think it's still probably a major factor in the world today, but it also interacts directly with the oligarchy that is tied to the black nobility, the old hereditary bloodlines of the Roman Empire and probably earlier even the Babylonian Empire that have a direct continuity to the current age. So I don't know. Did you have any thoughts? I know there's a variety of ways we could approach that. I've put together a few slides and images. I don't know if you've thought about this or have any ideas how you'd like to broach it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to me it makes sense. I know people like the maps, and I know people like kind of a high level introduction to try to connect it to other things they're more familiar with. And everyone kind of knows the Roman Empire. So I thought that maybe we would talk about the collapse of the Roman Empire and kind of draw like a through line of how Venice became important kind of as Rome was losing its, the Roman Empire at large was losing its prestige in terms of being a global, and I say global, like the known world empire. So I thought maybe we'd just start there and maybe talk about some of the elements that I have some maps to show that won't be directly related to everything we're going to discuss, but I think we'll provide some context because I think it's nice to get some context clues to before we jump into the specifics of Venice. So why don't I share my screen?
Yes.
And I will just kind of provide a little bit. Let's see, we got. All right. So last week we were talking about these maps over here. We're talking about the Templars and all that and how, the Crusades came over mostly from France in the beginning, and then eventually you kind of got the English involved. But mostly it was the French, Italians, and even some Germans. I wanted to talk about, so the Roman Empire officially collapsed in 493. That's the date that everyone pegs it. And that's when the boy emperor, Romulus Augustus, surrendered the crown to a Gothic invader known as Orestes, right? Make sure I have that name right. I think it's Orestes is who he, yes. And so Orestes was, what he had done is, I'm sorry, his father was Orestes. Romulus, so Orestes had joined the court of Attila the Hun. So I wanted to talk about Attila the Hun real quick. So, when people think about the Huns, and this is something that I think is a little interesting, and it kind of caught me off guard when I was researching this years ago. And, I used to think of the Huns, I used to conflate that with the Mongols and be like, oh, okay. So the Mongols came down, the Hun, like, what's the difference between the Mongols and the Huns? Hmm. So the Mongols were a purely Asian, like Mongolian tribes. They came from like the area just north of China, Mongolia. The Huns were actually from Hungary, like this area. This is the where the Attila Huns reach. So they're actually different. And I wanted to explain how those two groups were related. So you have, I remember last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, I mentioned the steppe. So everything you see here in turquoise is what's known as the steppe region of the world. And I mentioned how horses come, every horse in the world comes from the steppe. You know, whether you believe in evolution or you believe that God created these creatures and put them in an environment and then they spread out. This is where this is known as the steppe. And just so you get an idea of what the steppe looks like, it extends all the way from, this is Hungary right here, this like little like exclave that's detached. Then you have Ukraine, Crimea, and it goes all the way to China. And so here you have, this is what the steppe looks like in Ukraine. Here's the steppe at the Ural-Caspian narrowing, which is right here. You can see that where it narrows right here. You then have what's called the Kazakh steppe. So this is known as the Pannonian steppe. This is like the Eurasian, the European part of the steppe. You have the Kazakh steppe, which is right here. It then narrows again. And you get into the Altay Mountains. We talked about the Turkmen, who are like the modern day, like the Turk, who occupy Turkey. They became the Ottoman Empire. They come from this region right here. And then just on the other side of that, this is Mongolia, and this little like sliver, or like this like slithering flat land. You can see, so here's Kazakhstan. Here's that area I just pointed out where it narrows again. And then this is Mongolia and North China. So from Mongolia and North China all the way down to really Ukraine and then Hungary, this is what the land looks like. And you can imagine why that would be an environment conducive, not only to horses, but to nomads and people of the horse, so to speak. And then you had this group in Herodotus's day, which would be, you know, 500, 600 BC, kind of like when the Roman Empire was getting its beginnings. They mentioned the Scythians. So anyone who studied ancient Greek history has heard of the Scythians, and they're described as a nomadic people of the horse who are really, really great at archery, and Scythian boys could ride horses before they could walk. Like that was the myth that the Greeks would tell each other. They occupy modern day Ukraine, the Crimea. The Brown is where they actually had settlements, but mostly they were nomads who rode around on horses and tents. And they are easily recognizable because of the shape of this hat. Anytime you see a Greek painting or a Greek pottery or Greek ancient art, and they have a person wearing this hat, that is a Scythian. They're Iranian. That's their origin. And so a lot of people want to think of them like I used to think of them when I would study ancient Greek history in school. I thought of them as like an Asiatic people, but really they were like an Eastern European Iranian. And when I say Iranian, I mean like ancient Indo-European. So you would still have like an Eastern European Slavic sort of ethnicity. And then of course you had the Mongols come in around like 1100 AD and mix with the Eastern Europeans. And then you had, that's when you get the more introduction of kind of the more Asiatic look in Eastern Europe. But so this area right here, the Pannonian steppe is really like the Scythians right here. And so getting back to what happens when the Roman Empire collapses, well, you have this kingdom forms, the Ostrogothic kingdom. And it's only around for about 50 years, but it kind of serves as like that transition. You can see at the center of all of this is Venice, and you can kind of see how Venice kind of maintained like this important, an important hub. And I think we've talked about on the show before why Venice was so important, how it became a powerful hub, and that was because of the sea salt, and because of its topography. It's very swampy. It's very a lot of shallow water, and so you have that really salty Mediterranean water. When the tide would go out, that water on the rocks would dry, and you would get left with salt. And it was a very high quality salt that had a really, really nice taste to it versus the salt that they were mining out of the mountains. And today, I mean, any table salt that you're eating today, it comes from the ocean versus salt that you're putting on the roads and sidewalks is typically salt that's mined from a mountain. So that making that center, that Venetian center, that Venice really maintains a really important role as like a trade hub, even as the Roman Empire, as it's known, collapses. I think it's important to also point out that Italy really avoided much of what the rest of Europe knew as the Dark Ages, because all these, basically what happened is you had the Roman Empire spread out all over Europe. And as there, as the empire is collapsing, much due to decadence, the decadence that leads to corruption, a lot of what you're seeing today in the West with in America, they're pulling back all of their governors, they're pulling back all their forces. And so they're leaving all these areas in Europe. They were stretched as far as Britain. You know, they were up in northern Germany and France. They're in Spain. They're pulling everyone back to Italy because they can't maintain, they can't provide supplies or protection. And these are and the people that are ruling those regions are, you know, considered nobility. So they're pulling them all back to Italy. So Italy, while Italy certainly had some tumultuous times, it for the most part was able to maintain a lot higher standard and quality of life relative to the chaos that unfolded across Europe, as you had this huge power vacuum. And then you had barbarians and different tribes trying to compete for power, and just a total lack of law and order, which is what the Roman Empire kind of represented. And without that law and order, the chaos and the violence that then led to the rise of what people called noblemen, because you had strong men kind of stand up and protect the weak. And those people became what was called nobility, and eventually led to the creation of the aristocracy, the European aristocracy. I talked about how at GART about how the aristocracy of Europe was really built around real estate. And basically the king would have his kingdom, and then he would start to carve it up among his direct kinsmen who were in his direct circle. And then those kinsmen would carve up their little sliver into their lower ranks. And that created a pyramid and so on and so forth. And that created a pyramid structure of a hierarchy where the lower rungs had to pay taxes to the higher rungs. And if they didn't pay those taxes, they were stripped of their title and their land was given to somebody else. So they had a lot of incentive to basically squeeze the peasants in order to get their tax money so they could pay their taxes. And that power structure is really what came to define the European aristocracy for the next, you know, from the collapse of the Roman Empire right up until, World War One, really. I mean, it took Europe a couple centuries to kind of refine their economy and kind of transition from that system to what we have here in America. When America was created, that was one of the fundamental transformative ideas with America, was that you could own your own property and it wasn't the government or some nobleman bequeathing it to you temporarily. So I think it's important to kind of provide that context and just let people see that from a high level. So Venice, very important trade hub, and kind of survives to a lot of extent the collapse of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. And it touches on a lot of points that I'm going to contribute to this conversation. The point, I think, in terms of what happened to Venice, how did it also rebrand itself at a certain point when it went into an existential crisis? And how was something that's being promoted right now by King Charles? I find this is very interesting. I sent out an article. I'm going to include in the description box after this chat's over, regarding the Terra Carta and the Astro Carta. Did you get a chance to look at some of that?
I did get a chance to read some of it. I didn't get a chance to read the entire article, but I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
It's going to be interesting because I want to deal with both Venice and the Magna Carta because they're two sides of the same thing. And this is basically the image that was selected by King Charles to be the foundation of the Terra Carta. And on the right is the newly unveiled Astra Carta. And what they're basically trying to do is like the Terra Carta, you know, it basically outlines that we are stewards of the earth, and we have to basically, under the at the time Prince of Wales and his Sustainable Markets Initiative under the World Economic Forum, create a new treaty to take 30% of the earth's surface area out of human activity completely globally, and sort of get some binding thing. A bunch of religious organizations have signed on. A bunch, obviously, every UN group has signed on to this thing. The Astra Carta, I didn't know about until like this week. Both of them feature the British King's, you know, crown. With, of course, we spent a lot of time talking about the symbol of the Knights of Malta, which is also part of that thing. That's actually the logo for Amalfi, the city. The at some point it was the rival city state to Amalfi, where a lot of the Russian the Roman oligarchs went to seek a sanctuary after the Western Roman Empire broke down. And that became sort of the hub of what is today credited as the source of mercantile capitalism in the ninth century. It was Amalfi's role in controlling spice trade, other things. It took a little while for Venice to become the alpha top dog. But the point being is that this Maltese cross, very important that that's there. Now, the Astra Carta professes to extend this logic to the entire universe, as we see with their logo of the celestial sphere. They have a whole website for either one of these things. Each one has their own website that King Charles is somehow overseeing. To call for creating a charter to be stewards of the universe under the British supervision of the crown. Like, it's wildly hubristic. So what is all of this? You know, and you touched already on the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, right? How it broke down into like little factions of warlords, Ostrogoths and Visigoths, and, you know, different pagan groups and Picts and what have you, and Anglo-Saxons and Jutes. So this thing grew and grew. But at a certain point it completely was unmanageable. And you had the figure of Charlemagne, specifically his grandfather, then his father Pepin, then him, who were able to sort of consolidate this thing. They overthrew the Merovingians. The Merovingians were known as the sorcerer kings. that was what they were reputed to have been, even after they nominally converted to Christianity. They're still known as the sorcerer kings, and they're the ones there's this oligarchical myth that was created that they're the progeny of the babies of Jesus and Mary Magdalene that went to France after after Jesus didn't die. They had babies. The babies created a sacred bloodline that goes through the Merovingians and, you know, animates the special sorcerer blood of the hermetic special high level families and their bloodlines of the royal nobility. So that's the myth that they created for themselves. I don't believe it at all, but the point is the oligarchy creates myths. That's part of what they do. And then they end up kind of believing in their own myths down the line. So it's a weird quirk of oligarchical systems that happens. Point is, Charlemagne overthrew the Merovingians. They, you know, and established what's known as the Carolingian Renaissance, where we had this ecumenical relationship of different kingdoms from Islam, Christian, Jewish, Chinese alike, that were all working together under an idea of looking for common interests, win-win cooperation. So that had to be destroyed. So we discussed the Crusades. You also just recapped it. We don't have to go through that again. But today there's been something that I find interesting. So King Charles, when he was inducted and coronated, I showed this image last week too, but it's good to recap this. He's fitted out with that same symbol of Charlemagne that was bestowed upon Charlemagne as a bit of a trick in around 800 AD, when Charlemagne was a little bit too renegade and independent as an operator, and he'd rejected like five times offers to become the Holy Roman Empire because the Vatican was a lot less powerful. And they wanted to get control of this person who wields a lot of political power. So finally, he was invited to a Christmas party in Rome in the year 800. And as he gets out of his carriage, it's like kind of an entrapment where all of a sudden there's this massive like ceremony set up for him where they're like, oh, hey, welcome. By the way, surprise, you're Holy Roman Empire or Emperor. So they tried to get him on a bit of a leash. Around that time, that was the same period that Charlemagne's son, also known as Pepin, was deployed as the king of Italy to get control of Venice. And that was the siege of Venice. Pepin did a 6-month battle. He defeated a lot of the city-states that were sort of satraps of Venice. But something happened. Who knows what the real story is, but he just died. He died during the siege. They say, you know, it was just too disease. The lagoons were too disease-ridden, and he died. And that was sort of, and the Venetian doge that was trying to negotiate an agreement to get away from the Byzantine Empire and to join up with or to become subservient to Charlemagne, he was also killed. So that didn't last long. There was like an inside effort and an outside effort. Both failed. Venice is good at that. But the figure of King Charles comes up quite a bit. And the British Empire as a whole, which is not really British. And that's why one of my last books that I wrote is The Anglo-Venetian Roots of the Deep State, to get across the Venetian pedigree of Britain. And there's a figure named Benjamin Disraeli, right? An occultist, high-level occultist prime minister, who made, a very interesting observation. And he just said the great object of the Whig leaders in England from the first movement under Hampden to the last most successful one in 1688, which is an important year.
Very important year.
Was to establish in England a high aristocratic republic on the model of the Venetian. Two great Whig nobles, Argyll and Somerset, brought in a new family on their own terms. George I was a doge. George II was a doge. They were what William III, a great man, would not be. George III tried not to be a doge, but it was impossible materially to resist the deeply laid combination. He might get rid of the Whig Magnificos, but he could not rid himself of the Venetian Constitution. And I just love that quote. It's great. Because he's talking about not only the Venetian hand behind the takeover of England effected in 1688, which I'm going to say something about, and I'm sure going to be able to, you're going to contribute some thoughts to that too, but also to the fact that George III, the Hanoverian king, George III, who was there while the American Revolution was happening, was known as Crazy King George, right? Mad King George. He went crazy. And why? Because as Disraeli points out, he tried to break out of the Venetian Constitution. He was trying to resist. He actually was he was sympathetic to the American cause, as I've come to discover. He was organized by one of Benjamin Franklin's friends, Benjamin West, who was the president of the British Royal Society of Fine Arts, who was the same age as King George III, and befriended him and was organizing him philosophically. And he would be kept late into the early hours of the morning in philosophical discussion about the nature of, like, what is the purpose of government. And so he was actually organizing King George III. And then King George III couldn't deal with being expected to be at the center of a world satanic system. And he was driven nuts. He ended up getting taken out of his last 10 years were lived after he was sort of removed from power. So that never happened before in Britain's case. So all that to say, so Britain, strange phenomenon. It is not what people think it is. And again, going back to Charlemagne, that Charles obviously has delusions of grandeur, right? He's got this certain mystique of living as the new Roman Empire or emperor, in the walk of Charlemagne, but then some. He's also the guy who they assigned to be the initiator of the Great Reset, right? So on June 3rd, 2020, he's the guy who put out the, as we move from rescue to recovery, therefore we have a unique but rapidly shrinking window of opportunity to learn lessons and reset ourselves on a more sustainable path. It is an opportunity we have never had before and may never have again. We must use all the levers we have at our disposal, knowing that each and every one of us has a role to play. Now that's the Great Reset launching. And you know, so he was officially given that assignment to do that. And I say given it because I don't think he's a thing unto himself. And people think, okay, the British Empire today, it's not a factor. really? Like, these are just words. And it's like, well, it's called the Commonwealth of Nations. But it's still, if you look at the map of the Commonwealth of Nations today, it's about 25% of the world's surface area. Like, it's 2.2 billion people, you know. It's pretty big. And if you compare that to what the British Empire was, it's not that different. So this is British Empire in the 1920s. And this is the British Commonwealth of Nations today. 54 nations under the crown. It's not that different. And this is like not even accounting for things like the fifth columnists inside of the United States that created Wall Street, that have been always loyal to the city of London. The influence of the British Empire, very clear. The new colonialism, it's a report that came out pointing out that the 101 companies listed on the London Stock Exchange, mostly operating through the British offshore tax havens, like in the Cayman Islands, but also in Canada, they control the vast majority of African resources. The vast majority, over $1 trillion of the most valuable resources of Africa, are controlled by specifically these mining cartels that are London or on the British Commonwealth, Barrick Gold or De Beers, things like that. Another aspect of this invisible empire, very Venetian, is this is a screenshot of the Crown Agents website, the Crown Agents Foundation. And Crown Agents is an international network affiliated with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It was set up in 1833. And it basically is set up to be an emanation of the Crown as a semi-private organization that it has one owner called the Crown Agents Foundation. Again, based in the Cayman Islands. Its responsibilities involve deploying and managing health care and energy resources for Ukraine, for a variety of nations. They have a big website, Myanmar. They're operating in South Sudan, big time in South Sudan, which has a lot of issues right now and with civil war with the North, and has for a long time, but that's a big reason why. Drug money laundering, HSBC, Bankuts, like some of the biggest, most powerful banks centered in London, were caught red-handed laundering billions of dollars. They were caught laundering in drug money. This is the Senator Carl Levin hearing report from 2012, proving that HSBC has been doing this for decades, but they're not alone. Again, it's a London bank that grew out of the Opium Wars. And a lot of this, as I pointed out, has a lot to do with the City of London here on the right. That's the logo for the City of London. And just like the Terra Carta and Magna Carta, these are terrible ideas. But Americans have been told that their legal system, I don't know if you were told this, but this is what I heard in school. You were, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a huge lie that the American Declaration of Independence is an emanation from the precedent of the Magna Carta, this great beacon of liberty. BS, mm-hmm. Crap, garbage, fakery, lies. The Magna Carta, when you actually look at this thing, it was in 1215, right after the Fourth Crusade, just as Venice consolidates control over the world. They've based or over all of what was formerly the Byzantine controls of trade routes. That's now Venice's control. Because the Fourth Crusade, I have a map of that. It was basically Venice screwing over there. It was a junior partner screwing over the senior partner in the empire relationship and taking over.
Hostile takeover, right?
Very hostile. Hostile. And the city of London, in the Magna Carta, so the city of London is a city within a city. It's called the Square Mile, but it's the center of global finance today. And it was 800 years ago. It was when this thing was being drafted. It already had existed. We don't know the history because it's very obscured. There's a lot of, but one thing about it is that they are a law unto themselves. They can't be controlled by the British government. They have their own courts, their own police, their own structure of control around the livery system of the guilds. That sort of are the controlling forces of the governance of the city. In the Magna Carta, which was done by enforcers of the city of London, various Norman robber barons who had taken over control of England in 1066 with the William the Conqueror. These were basically like Viking pagan Normans who had taken control of France a bit earlier, and they had basically taken hugely violent takeover in 1066. And they basically established feudalism. Before that, there was no feudalism in England. It wasn't there. The Normans were the ones who enforced feudalism, basically reducing human beings to possessions on a feudal landlord's estate under the barons. And the barons were these private entities, these private interests that would like organize as warlords and would constantly be at odds, obviously, with the administrators, the king and company. And there's constantly this effort to try to get them under some form of national control, get them to do some, like, abide by some set of law. And they wouldn't do it because it's like, you know, who has the power makes the law in their minds. So finally, they
might make right.
Might makes right. Pure Hobbes, mm-hmm. Hobbes before Hobbes. And they hoisted this thing at a certain point onto King John, which basically said, and these are just three of the elements, that the city of London shall have all its ancient liberties and free customs by land as well as by water. Furthermore, we decree and grant that all other cities, boroughs, towns, and ports shall have all their liberties and free customs. But these are all economically under the control of the barons, the barons and the livery companies. Earls and barons shall be immersed only by their peers and only in proportion to the degree of the offense. So basically they're saying that immersed means punished. So if you do something illegal, they can't be punished by the king or the nation. They can only be punished by their own fellow criminals, basically. a clerk in holy orders shall not be punished in respect to his lay holdings, except as previously described. So they're basically also trying to like bribe the Catholic Church to say, hey, look, if you support the Magna Carta, we're going to give you full access as well to... You could be a criminal as well and do what you want to do, and we'll make sure that you're protected. The only people who got shafted in this thing were there's a section that a lot of today's conspiracy theorists tend to like because it attacks the Jews, basically saying the Jews, anybody who dies while having a debt to a Jewish moneylender, their family won't have to pay those debts. Now that seems kind of good, you know, especially if you have this cartoonishly evil idea of the Jews as purely evil moneylenders. However, they also say in the next article that any debts that are owed to the barons must be paid in full. So they're basically pretending, if you read it, you might imagine that only the Jews control the money lending, but it's actually not the case. The barons themselves and the Normans, the Lombard bankers are pretty big, controlling a big chunk of that. So it's a sort of part. Yeah.
Well, and wasn't it, I don't know how if we even mentioned this or thoroughly got into this, but wasn't it these groups that we were talking about last week, like the Templars, like weren't they given permissions to get into money lending that did not, those permissions were not like only, like Christians were not allowed to engage in usury up until that point. And then at that point, in order to raise money and help fund these crusades, they allowed them to get, you know, they bent the rules for those guys. So these mercenary groups effectively were able to get into money lending.
Yeah, exactly. And they weren't technically allowed to kill other people too, because that's also frowned upon by like the teachings of Jesus. But yep. That's where you had this whole set of logical legal arguments made by Bernard de Clairvaux that said, well, but you know, if it's a heathen, they're already sinning by being a heathen. So the killing a heathen is actually good, and you're doing God's will and Jesus's will by doing that. You'll get into heaven. Don't worry. Just you know, and join the crusade. all sorts of legal.
Yeah. So everyone can understand, who's listening can understand like that. Like what we're saying is, you take, everyone understands what most people who are Christian, who or at least familiar with Christian teachings, it's like that's where you subvert the religion, and it becomes an institution. Like an institution of power. It's like, all right, we're going to take this idea that has like some purity in its origins, whether or not you're a Christian and subscribe to it, you can understand that it creates a moral structure for creating societies and promoting, you know, prosperity. And then they take it and they turn it on its head and they say, okay, you're not supposed to kill people. However, if you're killing the enemies of God, if you're killing the enemies of Jesus, that's okay. And then you can kind of take that framing and extend it to Islam and extend it to basically any religion and see how that could, the similar thing could happen to any religion.
Yeah. Yeah. We also have to be, all have to be on guard on how that works. That's very important. Mm-hmm. How about we do this before going into some images on Venice specifically, because I got some stuff on Venice that I want to introduce. How about we do a commercial?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. All right, cool. All right, so let's hear You want to do the first one?
Yes. Let me do, I will do the EZRX. And now is this, it's two videos. So I'm just going to read it. And if we play two videos, I'm not sure how long the videos are since you have them, but I'll just read
them. Yeah, they're 1 minute. So I think the first one has to be read. The second one probably does not have to be read.
Gotcha. All right. Then I'll read, I'll go ahead and do the reading.
Okay.
All right. We constantly talk about health and different ways to help and get many questions about ivermectin and where to get it. That's where we've partnered with EZRX. They have a huge selection of meds at badlandsmedia.tv/EZRX, or click in the description box below and use promo code BADLANDS for 10% off your order of $150 or more. EZRX not only has a huge selection, but also quality assurance, big savings and fast shipping. If you're looking for ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, finbendazole, then they're there today. Don't forget about finbendazole. They've tested finbendazole on worms or parasites that can live inside of us without obvious signs and can lead to health complications from bowel obstruction to loss of appetite, loss of weight, anemia, lung infection, and liver congestion. Some people have stated that finbendazole has even helped them with their cancer. Watch this clip of Joe Tippin's finbendazole story.
My liver, my pancreas, my bladder, in my bones. It was everywhere.
Joe Tippin says he was told to go home, call hospice, and say his goodbyes. The doctors were unanimous. He was going to die of small cell lung cancer.
Once that kind of cancer goes that far afield, the odds of survival are less than 1%, and the median life expectancy is 3 months.
Tippin says he got a tip, not from a pharmacist, but a veterinarian. And in his desperation, he turned from people medicine to dog medicine. Specifically, finbendazole.
Truth is stranger than fiction, you know?
Just 3 months later, Tippin says his cancer was gone.
My insurance company spent $1.2 million on me with traditional means before I switched to a $5 a week medicine that actually saved me.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, let's see. It says that's badlandsmedia.tv/EZRX, promo code BADLANDS for 10% off your purchase of $150 or more. Check it out today. That's EZRX. And cool. Everyone, please, if you're enjoying this show and this conversation, please hit the thumbs up and share this with your friends.
Absolutely. Please do. So there's more. So we already saw this quote, right?
Mm-hmm.
George III couldn't break from the Venetian Constitution. We've been introduced to Venice.
And real quick, if you can explain what a doge is.
Well, that's what I, yeah.
Yeah. You want to do that where you're going?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, my understanding is it's basically like the head of state in one of these Italian city states. And it's important to understand that Italy did not unify as a country until the 1800s. So until the 1800s, basically Italy was a collection of kingdoms, oftentimes that were in conflict with one another. Florence and Rome had a lot of back and forth conflict during the Renaissance. A lot of that had to do with these free ideas and this free thinking that was happening in Florence, like the explosion of art and expression, and how that kind of flew in the face of Rome and, you know, their more orthodox, old school, you know, kind of like the conservative liberal paradigm, so to speak. But you can see the doge in that picture in the middle there. I think that's Leonardo Lordan, if I'm saying his name right. In the picture of those three guys that you have, and you can see the hat is very similar to the Scythian hat, which is the Scythians. I saw Roger 5x5 threw it in the Rumble rants earlier, but Scythians were a Turkic Eastern European people, you know, like out of Ukraine. So it's interesting that you see this Eastern European influence over these Italian rulers.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a Phrygian cap or an homage to that, but I guess it could be also the Scythian cap.
It could be, yeah. It could be
Phrygian. You might be right, though, because it is very Byzantine. You're right. There is, like, when you go to Venice, there's an immense amount of Eastern Oriental Byzantine, architecture everywhere that kind of just doesn't fit for, you know, you go anywhere else in Italy, you don't see that sort of phenomenon. And you're like, why? Where is all of this coming from? And this is where it gets really interesting. Because, yep. Well, first of all, it's a peculiar type of structure of government. It's super stable. They never really had any, they had in their whole history, two attempts, one from the guy working with Charlemagne, a doge in like 805 or something. And then one more in like the 13th century of a doge that tried to do his own thing, who immediately got his head cut off in St. Mark's Square, immediately, like 2 seconds. So very stable, but the doge is there for life. That's the top sort of the duke. It's like a duke. It comes out of that it's related to the word doge. The structure is run by lower committees. So you have sort of this thing that keeps itself in check. So below the doge, which is the prima inter pares, sort of the first among equals, then you have a committee of three. And below the committee of three, you've got a committee of 10. And below the committee of 10 is the general Senate, where every member of the hereditary families, about 2,000, can be members of the Senate. But that's pretty much it. And you have this very, very harsh wall between the massive impoverished citizens of Venice who, I mean, the poverty was world-renowned. There was no ability to interface with the government in any way. It was really like a strict slave master type of structure with a very limited sense of being a republic because they called themselves the most serene republic. But they gave the word republic a very bad name because it really doesn't mean that at all when you look at how they actually executed action. Now, the thing about the Committee of Three is that they were also in charge of the accusations. So all around Venice, you had these little bronze lion faces with their mouth open that people would be encouraged to put the name of somebody who they perceived as being a threat to the state. So there was like, it was like a police state. Something like one out of four people were informants. It was kind of like the FBI, right? It was just everywhere. Everyone was afraid of speaking, of giving their public opinions about political matters in cafes. Everyone was very self-censoring and afraid of their neighbor. Kind of like, again, like the McCarthy era of the United States, where if you say the wrong thing and your kid hears you, you don't know if your kid might report you to their teacher because you're criticizing the U.S. becoming an empire or something. And then all of a sudden you find yourself unhirable. You've lost your job. You don't know why. Same sort of thing. And the Committee of Three had an absolute death penalty. They could dole out the death penalty. So this is where, you know, the lagoons became, or not the lagoons, but the canals became famous for dumping bodies. And the next day, the person whose name would be in the lion's mouth, they would have a secret trial. If the Committee of Three found them guilty, they would disappear. And again, this is like the image we showed you, alluded to, the different city states, right? No whole nation. Venice is the lion stepping on the Bible, probably a little double meaning there. Over there you got the another image.
And I mean, if you go back that right there, the upper right, that's the flag of England. I mean, that right, the white field with the red cross is the flag of England. So there's a connection right there.
Yeah, that's an element of that. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a composite. So the thing I really wanted to get across here is this is the thing, right? So where did all of this Byzantium and Oriental and Arabic sort of like styles of designs and architecture come from? Well, they stole a lot of it from Constantinople. And that's sort of the, like you said, the violent takeover, right, of 1204, 1202 to 1204. This is called the Fourth Crusade, entirely sponsored by Venice. That's the image of it there. Starting from Venice, they supplied all of the ships for the Christian crusaders at a high expense. It was very, very, very costly. And there was an agreement along the way that, okay, well, how are we going to pay off the Venetians who gave us these giant loans to pay for our private mercenary armies? And how are we going to pay for these boats? Well, before we go to the Holy Land, let's take a stop over at Constantinople and another city in Byzantium too. And let's just lay siege. and basically loot them, which is what they did. So you have one Christian army destroying another Christian city-state, looting them, killing thousands of men and innocent people, non-combatants, stealing all their gold, their architecture, their paintings, and bringing it back to Venice to pay Venice for all of the debts. And then they're like, well, you know, we're carrying so much loot, we can't really go to the Holy Land, so let's just go back home.
Which, by the way, that directly contributes to the fall of the Byzantine Empire to the Ottomans, which is why the Muslims are then able to take over Constantinople and convert it into Istanbul. And they convert the Hagia Sophia from the largest cathedral in the world into a mosque. And that's directly because of what the Venetians did, what the other European Christian kingdom did. And Odoacer is the guy's name. I said Orestes before, but Orestes' son is Rob. You know, he joins Attila the Hun. So Attila the Hun is obviously like a Scythian descendant, forms the Huns, comes out of like Hungary, and then takes over, you know, he joins his house with Orestes. Orestes has a son who is Romulus Augustus, and then a Romulus Augustus is who surrenders the crown in 493 to Odoacer. And Odoacer, who's an agent, who's an Ostrogothic agent, he basically openly says, "I'm an agent of the Byzantine Empire." So it's like the Byzantine Empire comes and kind of destroys the Western, like the Eastern Empire destroys the Western Empire, and then the Western Empire comes and destroys the Eastern Empire, and it's kind of this cyclical process where you basically have like an Ouroboros of Christianity, of these Christian empires destroying one another, which leads to ultimately the net effect is the Muslims taking over Constantinople and turning it into a Muslim kingdom.
Interesting. And what you're saying, that this also plays into, I was just reading this before this show began. Webster Tarpley had done something interesting many years ago on the Normans, and he made the point that the Norman invaders that took over in 1066 over England, and England had some quite good kings that were connected directly to King Arthur, like the real King Arthur, not the myth of the Round Table guy that was cooked up to promote the Crusades, not that, but the real King Arthur, who was like actually living, fighting in the end of the sixth century. That guy, he had a network, like a lineage, that was tied ultimately to the Tudors that took back control later on. But there's this figure named Alfred, King Alfred the Great, who was a major reformer walking in the walk of Charlemagne, very inspired by Charlemagne's reforms against the oligarchy for, you know, providing mass public education. And he put into motion for 20 years, this huge upshift in the culture, in the physical economy. And that had to be destroyed because it was threatening. Now, one of the key guys who, so the Norman invade, the 1066 Norman invasion was made possible by the 1066 Norwegian army of King Harald Hardrada, who launched the first attack on England, and they defeated them barely, but they were so weakened that they were then vulnerable for the takeover by the Normans that same year. But King Harald of Hardrada, who was managing the Norwegian army, was the Byzantine general, and he was the imperial guard commander in Constantinople. So he was a direct agent of Byzantium deployed to destroy England at that time, and it was obviously working also very closely with the Norman pagan occultists, who brought in feudalism and really subdued, and then brought in later on the Magna Carta, and that established and enshrined the powers of the city of London as sort of a power unto itself. Kind of like what Venice was, right? Or any of these city states, they were like, they don't want to have any external like nation state telling them what they can or cannot do. They are gods, right? So then it's just a question of gods fighting gods, which is, I think, also where you get when you look at like Orestes, the other Orestes, the Orestes trilogy by Aeschylus, or Aeschylus's works on Prometheus Bound or other things. There's these stories of the gods fighting the gods in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. I think what Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles are doing is they're actually showing you the insanity of how the oligarchy, who sees themselves as immortals, that they want to try to project themselves as though they are gods above the mortals who you can't really bother challenging. They're actually exposing the degenerate, debauched insanity of these like Zeus and all of these other like gods of Olympus who are all like screwing each other and going. Like it's so petty, but that's the oligarchy. That is the actual oligarchy that they're exposing.
That's really interesting, because that makes me think of like Burning Bright. He's a fiction writer. That's like his background, and he always talks about how it's easier to tell people the truth using fiction than it is to tell them using like reality. Like people will suspend their belief, and they'll suspend they'll check their beliefs at the door when they're engaging with fiction. But as soon as they start reading history or reading like reality, they're going to bring all of their preconceived bias to the door with them, so they can't wrap their heads around, you know, certain narratives. So he's just saying that it's easier to teach people about, you know, like lessons and everything using works of fiction. So I think that's really interesting.
Well, go on.
I'm sorry.
It just reminded me of Shakespeare, right? And if you look at like Shakespeare's Othello or The Merchant of Venice, if anybody gets a chance, if people are listening and they want to do something really good for their mind, read Shakespeare. If you can find a good performance of it, try to watch it, but it's hard. But you can read it, and you're basically being given the best lessons about the nature of Venetian control's manipulation of their target victims that you'll ever get anywhere. But it's given to us in fiction, and Shakespeare's educating Queen Elizabeth and her court. He's educating the population as a whole. When he's showcasing how is it that these Venetian operatives like Shylock are able to carry out the destruction of their enemies? What is their nature? What do they do? What about Othello's advisor Iago in Venice, right? And they all take place in Venice. And he's profiling Othello, a good Moor, a good general. But he psychologically identifies his weak spots and is able to work his jealousy, his different weak moment things that he hasn't fixed or identified in his own mind, and is able to then get him to destroy everybody he loves, including himself and his beloved wife. And Iago's just like, that's pure Venetian methods of getting the enemy to your victim to destroy himself, so that you can kind of keep your hands dirt clean.
Interesting. And I can't help but just think about Niccolò Machiavelli and The Prince, which is a book that he wrote for the Medici in Florence. And basically, for those who haven't read The Prince, it's kind of like fiction, but it's kind of like The Art of War, but from the perspective of a total sociopath who's trying to take over the world, a kingdom, whatever. But like, here's how you do cloak and dagger things in order to maintain your rule through the premise of might is right. That's what like The Prince is all about, and it's considered, you know, kind of like the handbook of how to keep your grip on power and not be subverted by your enemies. And that comes out, you know, I believe in the 15th or 16th century. So, right like around 15, that time.
Yeah, that was 1508 or something. Yeah.
1508.
But that was actually that on a side note there, that's going to play into the League of Cambrai actually. Cause Machiavelli actually isn't what many people think he is. And,
I can't help but feel like if The Prince was almost kind of like a red pill, like he was attempting to red pill people with that. Like I sometimes I feel that way.
It was real politic, but I'll show you something. So this is again the most serene empire of Venice, right? So it's pretty expansive, trade routes over the seas everywhere. They've completely taken this by the early like 1500 or so. Now they're organizing forever wars in Europe, where the European, you know, different factions are fighting each other in forever wars. Even before Protestantism comes up, there it's already happening. It gets worse after that, like after. But I'll say up here, this is the thing. So everybody kind of realized at a certain point that
go back to that map. I just want to point out one thing. Yeah. So. Look at the place we're talking about, everyone. We're talking about Egypt. This is before the Suez Canal, so they're going to the Nile. We're talking about Syria, so they're going to Syria right there. Look, they have Cyprus, that giant island right next to Syria. They have Ukraine. They have Crimea. They have Constantinople. They have all of like the western coast of Turkey, the whole Mediterranean coast of Turkey, all the islands that you see throughout the Mediterranean. These are a lot of locations like Sicily, which is, of course, like the mafia, like comes out of Sicily. So a lot of places that we are looking at now today that, you know, from 20th century on that are important are all part of this like little network.
Yeah. And also, Crimea, they stretch right up into southern Russia. And in fact, it was Venice who was also sponsoring the Northern Crusades, too. They were big bankrollers for we don't have pictures of that here, but there were about five or six Northern Crusades into Russia, into Sweden, into a lot of like Eastern Christian like run nations or power areas that were attacked by Christians. So it wasn't really what we were told.
I also see that the vassals of Lithuania. That's in, I need to write that down. So it says, and her vassals, the duchies of Montserrat and Lithuania. That's very interesting that they're talking about Lithuania, because that's Putin was talking about Lithuania too when he was when he interviewed by Tucker.
So here's a lead that I still have to follow up on. A friend of mine who's an excellent researcher was saying that his research into the Northern Crusades was taking him, was causing him to entertain a hypothesis that seems to have carry some weight, that a lot of the Norman, sort of the Viking brood, the pagan Viking, because we're like, what are the Nazis thinking? Right? What is their idea of their past? It's, they've got this idea of a romanticized pagan Nordic Viking.
Beowulf.
Beowulf. That's the
I was just going to talk about how the Beowulf epic is coming out at the same time. Like you talk about 1066. That's like when Beowulf was really coming to fruition. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It seems like propaganda, kind of like the Grail myths later on was also propaganda for its own part of the Teutonic orders and stuff. And that would be part of the new like Gnostic mystery schools. But he's seeing evidence that I still have to look at, that the Normans ended up dominating and even settling in areas that they took over during the Northern Crusades, including a big chunk of what's today Ukraine. And so when you hear a lot of these like Nazi Ukrainians saying that we're not Russians, they might be telling the truth. They might actually see that their identity is located in these Nordic, Norman, and other, pagan groups. That actually seems to be probably true. Got to be verified though. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's something interesting here where Venice is almost annihilated. There's a moment, one of these pregnant moments of history occur when all of a sudden everybody stops fighting each other and they all gang up on Venice. And so this is the League of Cambrai. I have a chapter in my volume 4 of the Anglo-Venetian Roots of the Deep State on the introduction of the League of Cambrai, but this is basically established on December 10th, 1509, uniting the highly corruptible Pope Julius II, the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian, Francis Louis XII, who was pretty good, and Ferdinand I of Spain, who was okay, Augustinian Christian leaders of England and Netherlands, Thomas More, Cardinal Morton, King Henry VII of Tudor, who dies that same year, and Erasmus, who's the ambassador, an advisor to Cambrai, the Bishop of Cambrai, are the major diplomatic players who spend years organizing this incredible alliance. And everybody stops fighting each other and they all declare war on Venice. And for that first year, it's like Venice, their entire naval fleet is wiped out completely. All of their paid mercenaries fail. It's they're done. It's only like, it only needs a second sweep to come in and completely wipe off this, command structure of evil. You have just a few notable quotes of important people of that time who are commenting on the role of the Venetians. And I just got to read a few of these because it's so good. Cosimo de' Medici said, association with the Venetians brings two things which have always been rejected by men of wisdom, perdition and disgrace. King Louis the 12th, who ends up giving Da Vinci sanctuary when this thing fails and Da Vinci has to save his life by getting out of Florence and he ends up going to France. Louis the 12th says, Venetians were traitors in human blood, traitors to the Christian faith, who have tacitly divided up the world with the Turks, and who are already planning to throw bridgeheads across the Danube, the Rhine, the Seine, the Tagu, and the Ebro, attempting to reduce Europe to a province and to keep it subjugated to their armies.
Pope Pius II. That's fascinating because then that, like, he just points out a connection between the Turks and the Venetians. Yeah. So it's like there you go. Like, that might be where the Scythian hat might come from. Who knows?
It may be. They definitely had, they were definitely helping both the Mongols and the Turks at that period of the 12th and 13th centuries. So the Venetians, they were working the Mongols. They had special trading rights that the Mongols negotiated, giving them the sole monopoly over trading under Mongol controlled territory. and they used the Mongols to destroy the centers of learning of Baghdad to reduce Baghdad to rubble, and to kill the scholars en masse. They did the same thing to India. They deployed the Mongols to China. They deployed them to take control of Russia. Right, they were pressing on the borders of Hungary. And they were also using their assets within the early Ottoman Empire, the Turks as well, to basically destroy their rivals and their enemies, as we saw, as you alluded to, with Constantinople in 1253, getting totally annihilated, right? Uh-huh. And I love this one by Pope Pius II, one of the few excellent popes. There's not many, but this is one of them. And he's one of the key organizers who came out of the Ecumenical Council of Florence that tried to reunite the church, the East and the West, that had divided earlier, based around the idea that we're all made in the image of a living God, and that the Spirit emanates from the Father and the Son. It's called the Filioque, and that was like the principle that was going to unite the church. But the problem was the only groupings within the Ottoman, within the Byzantine area, within the Byzantine churches that were for it, were in Constantinople. And when 1450 rolls around and Constantinople is totally wiped out, it's all of those bishops that were allied to this strategy were all killed, and it was taken over by the Turks at that point. But anyway, he said here that as among brute beasts, aquatic creatures have the least intelligence, so among the human beings, the Venetians are the least just and the least capable of humanity. They are hypocrites. They wish to appear as Christians before the world, but in reality, they never think of God. And except for the state, which they regard as a deity, they hold nothing sacred, nothing holy. All law and right may be violated for the sake of power. Very true. Very true statements.
Yeah. And if you go back to that map real quick one more time, that just makes me think that I said Syria, but really what that is that's Phoenicia. So that the Phoenicians like settled that little area, like Lebanon, like modern day Lebanon, like the northern coast. It's like that's a lot of and then when you look at like where the Phoenicians were going, like Carthage and stuff, like North Africa. So there is like a little bit of I've seen speculation, and I've seen like people make connections between like ancient Phoenician. The Phoenicians, for those who don't know, are the guys who had the purple dye. So they would dye their sailboats, the sails in their sailboats purple. And they were the ones who sold purple dye. So everyone, like they got like diplomatic immunity. They could sail through a war zone with their purple sails, and nobody would touch them because nobody wanted to break their alliance with the Phoenicians. They wanted access to they were like the maritime trading power before, like in the ancient world. And then Venice becomes the maritime trading power. Mm-hmm. So I got to wonder if there's a connection there between the Phoenicians and the Venetians.
Yeah, I wonder, like a lot of these advanced because when you have an advanced maritime commercial society, you tend to have more science, because you have to, like, it's part and parcel when you're making your business navigating on the high seas, you have to be able to like know celestial astronomy quite well, whereas if you're just an agrarian, you don't have to. You just need to know the seasons. You don't need to understand the cycles of the heavens, the different mapping of the stars, like, so your mind power doesn't require as high level of activity if you're purely a land-based agrarian sort of civilization. But as soon as you go on the seas, it's like, no, you're dead if you don't know the mapping of astronomy very, very well. And you'll end up discovering certain cycles, certain laws of nature that way. And then that's a great, beautiful, good thing. But if you're animated, you could easily then see how that lends itself to corruption, because now you have a power with that knowledge over those who are ignorant that could then allow you to, let's say, forecast an eclipse, and other people don't know how to do that. So that might give you like sort of a magic trick to convince them that you have special insight into the gods that they don't have. So they should like rule over, or let you rule over them if they're superstitious, ignorant of basic things, because you just forecasted when the eclipse is going to happen, right? And that's how the priest class was able to sort of wield their power, was by keeping secret science to themselves. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that the science was bad, but that the tendency to be able to use it as a power over those who are ignorant is a thing, and it still is a thing today, right?
Yeah. Phonetic alphabet as well. Phonetic alphabet, where you look at a letter and it has a sound associated with it. The Phoenicians came up with that as well. So they were, you're right. They had a really high cognition, and it's just interesting listening to that guy listen to Pope Pius say that, aquatic creatures are some of the lowest life forms. And then it makes you think of like the British Navy, like the, you know, the British maritime power. It just kind of keeps going and going.
It's a cheap shot at fish, though. There's some smart fish out there. But here, so this is where it gets really wild. So we're like, Venice is about to be wiped out by this alliance of nations who stopped fighting each other and started working together. So what happens? So the league is sabotaged, 1510. Rome, Holy Roman Empire, which is Maximilian, Spain and England now are all of a sudden they're allied with Venice and everybody's at war with Florence and France. And you're like, what? What? How did that happen? What? Because it was just like a second ago that everybody's fighting Venice. So how did that occur? And also, right, then you have the Christianity. So it starts splintering from within, right? So the age of the new age of forever wars between Catholic versus Protestant wars begin. The Hundred Years' War, the 30 Years' War after that. Like it piles on forever wars. Counter-Reformation, 1534, Jesuits and Anglican cults created, steered from Venice at the same time. We'll talk about that next time.
Next week is gonna be the Jesuit episode, right? I think we talked about
that. Yeah, and we'll bring in Cynthia too, and she'll share some thoughts that are super interesting there. But so what happened? So during that league, you had Venice passes a massive bribe to Julius II, the Pope, basically saying we'll pay you like 10 times more for your alum holdings than they're actually worth in the markets, and we'll give you back your papal states. So like Venice had control of some of the papal states that they took over a few years earlier. And they're like, we'll give you all that back. So it was a bribe. And Julius, being a corrupt ass, you know, pagan masquerading as a Christian, goes along with it. And with him comes the whole Roman Empire, like Holy Roman Empire of which is today like Germany, pretty much, which is like Maximilian. That all then goes with him to have a new pro Venice alliance. Spain also, being under the influence of the Vatican, goes along with it too. England, because Henry VII, who's a really good king, is killed. He's dead in 1508. His son, Arthur, who was supposed to be the heir to the throne, dies the same year, probably poisoned. King Arthur, so he was supposed to be King Arthur, the son of King Henry the Seventh. He dies. So that leaves this nimwit, sex maniac, idiot, Henry VIII, to be now the king. And this guy's been profiled and worked upon since he was young. He had a few good advisors like Henry Thomas More, but it wasn't enough. The corruption factor was way too high. And he ends up like jumping in and supporting Venice as well against Florence and France. And then at this point, Machiavelli and Leonardo da Vinci, who are like close allies in Florence, they get their citizen army that they built up gets wiped out. Da Vinci goes and flees to France. France is doing a back channel fight, but it's really hard at this point. They get beaten down. Machiavelli seems to be, again, my take on him after doing this research is that he's good. And
that's kind of what I picked on. I picked up on that before too, as well, but continue.
Yeah. I got that he did this, a lot of other things than the prince, like the discourses of Livy, which really demonstrate a very beautiful mind and a beautiful soul with a lot of insights that isn't something you see so much in the prince. But the thing about the prince, when I was looking into it, is he never wanted that to be published. He wrote that specifically as a manual, specifically for one Medici prince that he was working closely with to do real politic in the real world, because the problem was you do have the Venetian methods that are trying to destroy you from within, from without. You got like traitors, fifth columnists everywhere. Like it's, they call it a Byzantine thing for a reason. And it's all shadow plays and cutthroat. So he's like, look, if you can't just be a noble philosopher king, good guy. You got to play the game. And and that was sort of a training manual for that guy that Machiavelli never wanted to be published, and it was published after he died against his will.
Fascinating. And now they promote that in colleges, like oh yeah, check out how nefarious this Machiavelli guy was. Because you're right, Machiavelli and Da Vinci like were friends, and they were working together to help the Medici in Florence. And that's interesting that Florence and France had their alliance, because the Florentines, like you have the Florida Lee. It's like that's a thing in Florence as well as in France. Mm-hmm. And Da Vinci, for those who are wondering how does an artist fit into this, he was a brilliant engineer, and he engineered lots and lots of war machines for the Medici, helicopters, tanks. He even, I think, submarines. I want to say he came up with some sort of a submarine, like submersible. So he was a very, very smart guy. And, you know, how much that stuff got built, we can't know. But he had flying machines and helicopters. So airplanes and helicopters, like gliders, like drawings of all that stuff. So brilliant, brilliant guy.
Yeah, at the very least, he definitely had drawings of like helicopters that may or may not, we don't know if they were ever built, or I heard somebody make a case that it would have required some form of a steam engine for that to function, to get the power necessary for the propellers to lift the thing off, because it would work kind of like an air screw, which is a cool idea. It could really work.
Yep.
I don't know. But the point is that the idea was there. He definitely did submarines, that's for sure. Like, not advanced, but yeah, significant stuff.
I thought he did figure out submarines too. And he did it. And the way he figured this all out, this is my favorite part about it, is he figured it out by studying nature. So like he would take bird, like, you know, he'd find a dead bird, or maybe he had a bird and he killed it, but he would take birds apart and he'd study the way their wings move. He figured out their bones were hollow. He figured out like how did nature make these things. And then he tried to replicate it. When it came to a tank, he studied turtles. And he said, like, how's a turtle shell put together? How does a turtle like interface with, how does a turtle move around? Like, very, very smart guy. And he figured he had a cluster bomb that he developed by studying pomegranates and like the way that like pomegranate seeds exploded when like you bit into them. And so he then figured out that if you wrapped these bombs in leather, you could then pouch them all together. And then when you launched them, they would split open and you could have a wider area of impact. So, you know, very, very smart guy. And that's why he's so highly respected by a lot of people.
Fantastic stuff. Wow. Yeah. Let's do a couple of commercials before you see how Venice took over England. Here, I'll do Gold Co. One second. Okay. Gold Co. Oops. Are you concerned about the $6 trillion at stake in the upcoming 2024 elections? The Wall Street Journal has reported a critical issue: the looming decision to unextending tax cuts scheduled to expire after 2025. Republicans advocate for extending Trump's tax cuts, while the Democrats lean towards letting them expire and increasing taxes on top earners and corporations, potentially creating a massive $6 trillion gap. But fear not, there is a way to protect yourself from this impending threat. Join the thousands of hardworking Americans who are taking proactive steps to safeguarding their savings. Visit BadlandsGold.com to claim your free 2024 gold and silver kit and fortify everything you've worked for. You may even qualify for up to 10% back in bonus silver, but hurry, supplies are limited. Don't leave your financial future up to chance. Act now to diversify and shield your savings against the uncertainties ahead. Get your free 2024 gold and silver kit today at BadlandsGold.com and take control of your financial destiny. And then Vanman. Have you had enough of big pharma and big toxic ingredients? Ditch the harsh chemicals and embrace nature with us. For too long, we have been hypnotized by big companies using their chemical shop slop products. Their clever marketing campaigns and heavy lobbying allow them to use words like natural to describe products that are nothing but anything but. Meet the Van Man Company, where we are about organic natural remedies. Hop in the van and try out our famous tallow and honey balm as a daily face and full body moisturizer. Use our miracle tooth powder made from ground eggshells and ground cattle bone to remineralize and naturally whiten your teeth. And try our new coconut magnesium deodorant to keep you smelling fresh all day. We got you covered, and we do it with all products sourced naturally from American farms and made in San Diego, California. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/vanman today and get free shipping on all orders over $40. Okay. Right. So basically, yeah, Venice kicks over the chessboard, right? They just like... That's the thing. When you can't win the game that you rigged, you just burn the whole casino down, and that's what Venice does really pretty consistently. And then, like I said, after they organized the Counter Reformation, the Jesuit Anglican cults created as well, steered from Venice. Then you got the Jesuit reaction the Jesuit run counter reaction or counter reformation known as the Council of Trent, to basically codify that no dialogue with Protestants will be allowed, kind of like Zelensky saying no dialogue with Putin is permitted by law. So of course, no negotiations, no chance of dialogue means forever war.
Yeah. Which is like similar rhetoric coming out of Israel right now, saying there's no chance that we're going to talk, have a negotiation with Palestine. Not right now. We're going to keep doing war. So it's like, you see this when there's no dialogue, there's no chance for peace.
No way. Yeah. Which is where the later on 1648 Peace of Westphalia becomes very useful, because that's, again, like one of these League of Cambrai moments where you have Jean-Baptiste Colbert, Mazarin from France, organizing all of the different like feuding princelings and prince electors who are all fighting each other in these Catholic Protestant wars for, you know, that killed like half the population of Germany. And they're finally able to organize an alliance based upon the well-being of the other. And the first within the charter of the Peace of Westphalia that establishes the modern nation state, it comes from there, 1648. And it basically doesn't just say we're all going to just agree to ignore each other. It says we will now all work for the benefit of the other. First article is everybody's self-interest is now based upon the self-interest of their neighbor. So that's a very Christian idea. The idea of forgiving all transgressions is article number 2, very important elements. And then later on, there's like 90 other like details, like, okay, this person will get this amount of territory, this one will get this amount of territory. But that's details. The preamble of the whole constitution that makes the sovereign nation state viable is not the right to be left alone. It's the right to work for the benefit of your neighbor. That's very different concepts, which is why the oligarchy has been trying to undo the nation state system for a long time. Because it's all based on looking for, well, what do we have in common, even though we have all this bad blood behind us, right?
Yes.
Yep. Before that happened, like Venice realized they had to move their sort of command structure away out of that. They thought that they were invulnerable like gods. They were actually more vulnerable than they realized with the League of Cambrai. It was a slap of reality. And this is where for the next over a century, the effort was finding a way to migrate to a more strategic zone of control. And that was, as you see here in green, is Amsterdam and the Netherlands, and which is also a hotbed of republicanism and anti-imperialism against the Habsburg Empire. That's where you had the uprisings of Flanders in the 16th century against Philip II, the revolt of the Netherlands. So there was also a lot of science, a lot of arts that were really growing in a really beautiful Renaissance manner in the Netherlands. Also in England, you had the networks of Shakespeare, of Erasmus earlier, of Thomas More, had a huge influence still on the culture. And, you know, so these were like the zones where there was the greatest goodness. And thus that's where they had to get control and destroy them from within. So they did that through this technique of private finance and occultism. So introduce occult secret societies, a lot of Gnostic, Rosicrucian type Kabbalist networks that seduced the aristocracy, that brought in intelligence operations into these zones, that then used their influence. Like this is what they were doing with Francesco Zorzi, the Venetian Kabbalist, who was a Benedictine monk, who was the advisor to the Pope and Henry VIII, who then set the stage for bringing in the next generation of Francis Bacon, of John Dee into the courts of Elizabeth, that then like created this whole shadow government, this parallel state. And then that facilitated this technique of introducing private finance. So they took basically the Venetian Levant Company as a Banco, I'm forgetting the name.
Siena?
Yeah, that's the one. Good. Yeah, that's right.
You have it written. You have it written on your slide right here. That's why.
Oh shit! I do.
Okay. I wish I could take credit for remembering that, but I'm just reading your slide.
Get out of my head, Gordon. Okay. Yeah. Right. So okay. So Venice's Banco Siena, and the London Company of Venice. So the Venice had a Levant Company, a London Company, and a Siena Company that were all like these private entities that were used as models to create the Dutch East India Company in 1602 and the Dutch Stock Exchange in 1608 and the Bank of Amsterdam in 1609. That was the first world like official private central bank was the Bank of Amsterdam. And then that, and at the same time, their agents were at work in England, setting up the British East India Company, the London Stock Exchange, and the Bank of England. But the Bank of England only happened a little bit later, right? And in Amsterdam, they basically had to destroy the economy by getting everybody into idiots, like what happened to America after 1971 we all started embracing consumerism and stock market speculation, or what was done in the 20s under the stock market bubbles, the roaring 20s, right? It was artificially created bubbles that would then naturally blow, as all bubbles must blow. And then you destroy and do a wealth transfer. So those in the know who knew that it was a bubble would be able to buy before the thing burst, and then buy for pennies on the dollar all of the real estate and other things that their rivals had control over, who were too stupid to realize what they were doing. And that's what was also done in England after the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which saw this, you know, stooge puppet king of the Netherlands, the William of Orange, installed to become all of a sudden the king of England. Not too bloody of a takeover, but it was facilitated by fifth colonists from the inside, like Lord Marlborough Churchill, who ran the British military, who was part of the Venetian party, along with Lord Cavendish, who we've talked about before, who were part of these old black nobility families, who were part of what was known as the Venetian party of England, that facilitated this transplanting of this puppet king into England, who then brought in the next phase over the Magna Carta, which was the charter that established the Bank of England, that re-empowered the city of London as the central command, that brought in Isaac Newton, right, from the basically this Kabbalistic occultist who's, had handlers, who was made president of the British Royal Society. He was made the master of the mint of the Bank of England in 1696. So this whole thing was then what it culminated in, affecting what Benjamin Disraeli had pointed out earlier, as far as, this Venetian constitution takeover of England that then became the central point of a new empire, which was this British Empire. So that then had the aspiration of becoming the seat of a new one world empire that wouldn't make the mistakes of Rome, which is why they commissioned Gibbons in 1776 to do his study of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. And Gibbons was commissioned by the British Empire in order to figure out how Britain could become the new Roman Empire, but without the mistakes made by the first one, so that they would fully, control the world and then the universe, as King Charles aspires to doing with his stupid Astra Carta, which people should just go to the website and read this thing. It's really hubristically insane. But yeah,
that's fat. I mean, so William of Orange, for those who are living on the East Coast or are familiar with College of William and Mary, that's like in America, when you learn about William of Orange and you learn about William and Mary, you learn about their very noble, like, ascent to the throne and how they brought like a lot of peace and stability. And it's very, very much like they're glorified in the, in the textbooks that are obviously printed by Ghislaine Maxwell's father, his textbook company. So they're absolutely glorified as these great rulers that have, which is why College of William and Mary is named after them. And then what you mentioned earlier, just hitting a few factoids, after the Council of Trent, you have 50 million Protestants in Europe killed by the Vatican. Through just a series of wars over that century. And that doesn't even count all the Catholics that were killed by the Protestants. So lots and lots and lots of Christians die, killing other Christians. And it's all because of politics. It really has nothing to do, at least I believe, I don't think it has anything to do really with religion or, what you believe. It's really just about power and secular power, and using religion as kind of a convenient window dressing to convince other people to go kill other people. So
absolutely. Well, and it's like this, they are Satanists, right? Like, at the end of the day, the secular power thing, it actually is.
That's what I think too. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that was interesting that I was just poking around with, trying to piece this together. And I don't know the deeper picture on this, but one thing that I noticed, is that John Dee was invited to go to Russia in, what year must have that have been? That must have been 1570 or 1580 something, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe 1590. And he set up, he and his son, who is another practicing occultist, right? This is the guy who was like managing the occult networks, taking over British intelligence with Francis Bacon. they set up the Muscovy Company, modeled on the British East India Company, to try to do the same thing to infiltrate Russia as well. And there was a battle with, you know, Ivan the Terrible was in opposition to this thing. It's so interesting. There's this whole amazing picture of history that I'm trying to find somebody who's done some good work on that, but I'm not getting any luck yet. It's just like just anomalies that are cropping up. But it's like, why is this British occultist all of a sudden in Russia setting up the Muscovy Company? And
well, and also the Virginia Company. So like a lot of the guys who were involved, like the people who were involved in set up the East India Company also set up the Virginia Company. They come and settle Jamestown. A lot of the same players who are like high ranking members in the Virginia Company or involved in the India Company. And it just makes me think that you have the whole English Civil War, which is all tied to what you were just saying, 1688, where it's Charles the First is deposed, and then you have the revolution, like Oliver Cromwell and the revolution. The guys in Virginia who were like loyal to Charles apparently send his son Charles II like a scarf or something. I forget the exact story, but they basically give him a sign that like, hey, we're still with you. And so that's why like when Charles II comes back into power after the Civil War, he refers to Virginia as the Old Dominion, and Virginia is considered like the sixth Dominion, because there's five kingdoms that make up like Great Britain, like in the logic of Great Britain. And the sixth kingdom is considered Virginia, which is why we are known to this day as the Old Dominion. And like Old Dominion University is a relatively newer university down in Norfolk. But that's why we're called the Old Dominion, is because we remained loyal to the British crown during the English Civil War. I can't help but wonder if it's all connected to the fact that Virginia Company, East India Company, Muscovy Company, they were all like the same thing, and these powerful players working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very good observation, because I mean, Canada is officially it was a dominion, right? It still, I believe, has legal claim as dominion, not as a real nation at all, because again, we're a British asset. It's interesting. There's this book that if people want, well, I found this to be of such high value. If anybody really wants a good read, high value read, is How the Nation Was Won, America's Untold Story from 1630 to 1754 by Graham Lowry. Whatever you got to pay online, pay it. This is gold. And it really goes into this dynamic of the various Republicans in England that were achieving positions of power, especially during the period of Queen Anne's reign. So when William of Orange dies, because he's super gay, he's not producing any babies, right? So the next in line is Stuart Queen Anne. She gets the throne, and with her, there's like one last sort of gasp for fight against this parasite that's taking over, and you got figures like Jonathan Swift, who's an advisor to Robert Harley, her prime minister, really good guy. Jonathan Swift, the writer, again, like what Burning Bright was saying, it's true. Jonathan Swift's fiction writings of Gulliver's Travels, his Tales from a Tub, his Battle of the Books, even his poetry is all covered. If you know what he was a part of and what he was doing and who he was communicating with, it's covered everywhere with solid messages pertaining to the fight. It's powerful stuff. So anyway, you have all Daniel Defoe, the guy who writes Robinson Crusoe, is working with Jonathan Swift and Robert Harley, the prime minister in England. They're working with forgetting his, anyway, there's a whole network. And they're actually drafting a national land bank in 1696, 2 years after the Bank of England is created. You got Jonathan Swift and Daniel Defoe drafting the national land bank for England to replace to basically undo the private central bank and create something owned by the nation that would emit credit for projects like canal building, schools. People can read this thing online, and it was created. Except the problem was that it was infused, kind of like the IMF was infused early on, right, by agents of the British Empire, so that it wasn't allowed to serve the role it was mandated to do, which was to provide credit for Africa and for other nations to become advanced first world countries. That was the why the IMF was created. And then it was turned into its opposite thing. It became an instrument for speculation and for destruction of nations. Now, that's with the National Land Bank in 1696. It was turned into the South Sea Company. So just like what happened with the tulip bubble in the Netherlands, right, where tulips were trading for the price of houses, they were just tulips. And then it wasn't even tulips. It was just papers saying that this paper represents this rare tulip from like Istanbul or something. But it didn't even exist. And people were like putting their whole family fortunes into tulip paper. Same thing happened with the South Sea bubble that was created through the South Sea Company, and which totally destroyed the English economy by 1719 when it burst. And everybody who was stupid enough to invest in it, they lost everything. Those in the know, huge wealth transfer, right, as always happens. And the whole like Robert Harley crowd completely lost. But during that time, there was a lot of effort to provide support to Cotton Mather, to John Winthrop Jr., to the Young Benjamin Franklin Network that was growing a base that would later on go to drive the American Revolution. And in the Civil War too, during that 10-year period of the British Civil War in the 1640s, that was also where you had the Massachusetts Bay Colony get its greatest liberties, to have independence, to generate its own credit, like the pine tree shilling, which was created as the first like colonial coin, to fund the Saugus Ironworks, which were like the first ironworks in a colony. The British never allowed that. So all of a sudden through the Civil War, they had all of the people around John Winthrop Jr. and the Puritan nation builders were all able to say, okay, let's take this opportunity to just like build up a real economy. Let's create a new city on a hill. And that was like the whole idea of what the city on a hill was supposed to be was, you know, and it set the stage for, again, the next generation of Cotton Mather, the generation of that after that of Benjamin Franklin, who then was always able to work sometimes with allies in England, but those allies in England were always, you know, working in the background. You know, very, very rarely were they not assassinated.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, you went back to the English Civil War, because the other thing I forgot to say is this is pretty important. So you had this guy, William Berkeley, who basically was the governor of Virginia for like 35 years, although not continuously. He was first appointed by Charles I in 1642. He then leaves Virginia when the English Civil War begins later in the 1640s to go fight for Charles I. Charles I is executed in 1649, and basically the Virginia colonists are like, all right, well, you're no longer governor, like F the crown. The English Civil War ends, Charles II comes back, and this all ties into like what I was saying about the loyalty. He then reinstalls Berkeley as governor in 1660, and he serves as governor from 1660 to 1677. Now, he implements some really, really, really like unpopular draconian policies in Virginia that lead to this this rebellion of like all the different classes, indentured servants, blacks, whites, everything. It's called Bacon's Rebellion, where like 1,000 guys, basically, which is a very large force for colonial Virginia in the 1600s, for a year, like take to the woods and are engaged in like guerrilla warfare against Governor Berkeley. That is credited. Thomas Jefferson says that Bacon's Rebellion is the preamble to and the inspiration for the American Revolution. It's exactly 100 years before 1776. It's 1676, 1677, and basically leads to Berkeley no longer being governor. But very, very important event, and it ties right into what we're saying about the loyalty of Berkeley to the crown, and then that loyalty being awarded or rewarded, and then the colonists revolting against him, throwing him out, and then 100 years later, American Revolution.
Wow. Is that where you have the colony saying basically threatened to cast off the British Empire or something? Like there's like some really strong statement saying,
yeah, basically it's like the colonists have been trading with the Indians and the natives and cultivating relationships. And Berkeley was like, you can no longer trade with the Indians. We're not doing this anymore. But that was like their livelihood. And at the same time, Berkeley refused, the crown refused to bring in any British troops. So once the trade and the dialogue with the natives stopped, the natives started attacking them because then they no longer viewed him as friends. And so there was no army there to protect the people from the natives. And so then naturally the colonists all turn on the British who are foisting these conditions. There are a lot of other things they did as well. Indentured servitude. Your first court case in Virginia, I think it was in the 1640s or 1650s, is in Northampton County, which is on the Eastern Shore. Three white slaves petition the court to say, hey, we don't want to be slaves. Like, we think this is illegal to be property. The owner of them is a black man from Angola who himself was a former slave, had earned his freedom through work, bought his freedom, become a huge landowner in Northampton County, and owned white slaves. Because of course you had black people owning white people. You had white people owning black people. You had white people owning white people. There are way more white slaves in the 1600s in America than there were black slaves. The slave trade hadn't really picked up from Africa yet. That was like East India Company, Portuguese India Company kind of stuff, Dutch India Company. And then once Bacon's Rebellion happened, that really instilled in the minds of the British, this is a real problem. This is a real, real problem. So they started passing what was called the slave codes in Virginia, which incrementally over the course of decades, they kept passing more and more. And that's really what you get as the institution of slavery, with black and white, and like the race-based slavery system that we all now understand was prevalent in like the 1800s, in the 1700s and 1800s. That was known, that started as the slave codes in Virginia. And it was all about preventing the races and the classes as well from uniting with one another and rebelling against the crown, because that's exactly what happened in Bacon's Rebellion. And they said, this is a problem. We need to basically make sure that these different groups can't find common ground and revolt against us. It was like, all right. Black people can't own white people anymore. White people can't be slaves anymore. It didn't happen overnight. It happened over the course of many years. But the very, very first time, because the court denied the petition, the court said, nope, based on the contract that you signed, which was indentured servitude, which would turn in basically to slavery, because you would rack up more and more debt and you couldn't buy your way out of your indentured servitude contract. They said, nope, you, based on the language of this contract, you white people are the property of this black person, this guy from Angola. You are property. That was the first time a court had ever ruled in America on a human being a piece of property, and it was white slaves and a black slave owner.
That's a hilarious, hilarious irony.
Charles Johnson.
Interesting. I'm going to use that. That's an important. That's a fun irony. But another on the issue also of this question of like slavery in America. There's things like the New York Times 1618 or 1619 project garbage. Trying to make it seem as though America was entirely an illegitimate country because it was just built on slavery and nothing but, right? And I already made a point that we've been lied to about the Magna Carta being the precedent, the British Norman feudal Magna Carta that enshrined the city of London as like a god unto itself. That is, we were lied to it. That has no connection to the American Revolution. In fact, the American Revolution was done to break away from that type of structure of control of Hobbesianism. Another one that we were lied about a big time, and you pointed out as well, there's mythology around William also that's romanticized. But another one is John Locke. John Locke himself was a British, like this guy was a key director of the British Royal Africa Company. John Locke is the guy who devoted his life to trying to prove that there is no soul, that we're all blank slates. And because we have no soul, we are just blank slates to be written on by those who have power, that there's no difference in owning a chair or a human. And thus, you can extend the laws of property to humans as well, because we don't have souls. And so that was part of the conditions around which he drafted the Carolina Charter. That made the statement, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property as sacred. And his idea of property was the thing he was making his millions of dollars on, which was the slave trade, which most of the patriotic colonialists didn't want. It was bought in and enforced by the British from 1609. The 1609 project, right? And it was enforced outside of the volition of those who were trying to resist it. And the British, at the same time as they were bringing in Africa slaves, of which there were like 8 million brought in before the revolution, they were getting the colonies addicted to this thing, but they were also destroying manufacturing. So every time you'd have something like the Saugus Ironworks in Massachusetts, or a hat manufacturing, or anything, or clothing textile manufacturing mills in Philadelphia or whatever, that would be destroyed, to the point that John Locke even participated in drafting a bill that illegalized manufacturing in the colonies. The idea was to keep everybody dependent upon human slave labor that was tied to this global cybernetics network of command, control, motion of goods and people around the world by the British, you know, empire, and to encrust like a local slave class that would be, you know, the landed gentry of America, that would then be kind of like the Norman feudalists of England. They just wanted to have every like local warlord class of feudalists that would then be loyal to the higher British Empire, because that's where their riches came from. They tried to do the same thing in Hong Kong with the Green Gang and the warlords there. They tried to do it in India with the Brahmins. That's why they even call the Boston Brahmins, right? Because it's like that was the higher caste of India that the British groomed and cultivated to be the local controllers over the rest of India. And they would stay loyal to the British controllers and they would get money, but they would have to do a lot of the dirty work to keep the lower castes under control. And they do that everywhere. And that was the role of both the Boston Brahmins in the North, the Cabots, the Lodges, the Lowells, all these groups that were based often in Virginia, making their money off the opium trade, keeping China subdued, while at the same time working with other, you know, slave power groupings in the South, that were just part of this local warlord class, that were always loyal to freeing fifth colonists and deep state operations inside of America, like Wall Street, you know, which has always been not American in its pedigree, or the FBI, the Scottish Rite, all of these things. These were always loyal to the United Grand Lodge. It was never an American Freemasonic group. It was always the British United Grand Lodge. That was the mother lodge of the Scottish Rite, north and south. So, yeah.
Yeah. Patrick Henry actually wrote a letter that was published, I think, by the New York Times in like 1860 at the beginning of the Civil War, where he like openly like criticized himself and all of the founding fathers for being hypocrites. He's like, here we are, you know, writing the Declaration of Independence, writing the Constitution, but we own slaves. He's like, but it's because this system has been foisted upon us where they're, it's impossible for anyone, like for any one person to just say, all right, well, I'm going to pay people to work on my farm as opposed to using slave labor. Well, then you no longer can sell your goods for a profit and there's no viable business model. They also outlawed, there was a prohibition put in place in 1808 on the importation of slaves. So after 1808, no more slaves were imported to the United States, starting in 1808. And what that did is it actually made slaves extremely valuable. It boosted their value for obvious reasons, because of supply and demand, but also because you couldn't bring in new slaves, you could only breed slaves, which is why you started to see like the breeding practices, especially like in like Mississippi, like on these huge cotton plantations. They would basically be looking for like breeding stock slaves. And then when you had Chinese immigrants and Scottish and Irish immigrants, especially Irish immigrants, come in, they were treated like dirt. Like they were viewed basically as like completely expendable, would work for pennies, you know. But slaves, of course, were treated with much more care. And this is where you get like the inversion of what like the woke mob probably thinks of when they think of this stuff. That's not to say that being a slave was great, but I'm saying they actually valued their slaves, whereas they didn't value the Irish and Chinese immigrants they were using to build the railroad and everything in the 1800s. Because if they died, who cares? Just bring in another one and pay them pennies to dig and work the fields and build the railroad. But slaves were very, very valuable because you could not only buy and sell them, you could breed them. So that's, you know, it creates that whole caste that you're talking about, like a ruling oligarchy, like an aristocracy, and then like an underclass, which we really saw come to fruition in South Carolina during the Revolutionary War, where there was like an actual civil war.
Right. Yeah. And also creates as a lesson for those who are getting manipulated by the weaponization of immigration today. like that's also a technique that the that those oligarchs also benefit from, is then they can induce the locals to become very hostile to the indentured servants, the Chinese, the Japanese migrant workers, the Irish migrant workers, because they're stealing your jobs and they're willing to work for less than you are. And that was the case in the 19th century. And there were riots. There were like lynch mobs that like lynched up Chinese workers that were brought in to build the transcontinental rail lines. And there was a lot of the Hearst publishing press, all of the press agencies were really happy to just inflame the aggression of the ignorant, like local citizens whose jobs were being, you know, taken away. There was economic downturns and they needed a hate object. So hate objects were presented as the immigrants, and nobody was paying attention to, well, who the hell is controlling this game from the top down anyway? And people forgot to look at the city of London. They forgot to look at the actual controllers, the local Brahmins managing the jurisdiction of the Americas. So yeah, very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting stuff. All right. Well, I don't know if you have anything else, but if not, we can hit some of these rants.
Oh yeah. Rants. Yeah. Let's do rants.
Yeah. Let's hit the rants. All right. All right. So Lucky Dog 31, $5. My favorite show. And I was one that didn't like history because of memorizing all the dates. Thanks for making history sexy. Smiley face. Thank you, Lucky Dog. That might be an allusion to during our geopolitics panel at GART, General Quast got up and said, we need to figure out a way to make geopolitics sexy. Because, like, in response to a comment John made where John said that he doesn't think, he thinks a lot of people don't find geopolitics boring, which is why people aren't invested in it. And so Quast said, if we could figure out a way to make geopolitics sexy, we could get people more into it, which I think is kind of what this show is about, like making history and geopolitics interesting. Because I said, you know, what if we could get people as invested in the drama of geopolitics and history as they are invested in, say, the drama of like reality television and like celebrities and like, you know, People Magazine and all that. And I really think it's about finding stories and being able to do like storytelling and narration, kind of like what we do here. And there's finding that like thread and that through line that makes it really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. 100%. Yeah. We got to find the drama. Like that's the thing. Human beings are, we talked about this before. We talked about this today, but yeah, like we're a creature of ideas. It's not genetics or our blood that defines who we're going to be. It's the ideas that we choose to love and work on and live by that defines who we are. And ideas are communicated through composition, through stories. And we're storytellers. Every child loves a story, right? It's universal. Every culture has that. And so, yeah, I mean, if we could find the drama, history is like Shakespeare said, right? All the world's a stage and we're all actors. If we can find where are the points of drama that make it come alive, then all of a sudden you can get, every kid would love history class in high school. Every kid would love it in elementary school. Like you, cause it's all tragedy. It's all classical tragedy everywhere you look. And tragedy is not just bad things happen to good people. That's not tragedy. That's tragedy is like where good people could have been better and they chose to be smaller at a moment where they needed to change and become better. And because they couldn't change, they became Hamlet. They became an Othello. They couldn't self-reflect or examine how they were being manipulated. And because they didn't activate that which they had within them, thus the tragedy unfolded, which didn't have to happen. And so that causes people to become more self-aware of themselves after experiencing a real piece of art like that. When they leave, they're more self-aware, self-reflective, that they don't want to have a little Hamlet within them dominate, or a jealous Othello. They don't want that to dominate. They're going to be more inclined to talk with their wife or talk with their friend instead of being jealous with their friend or jealous with their wife as Othello was. And Othello wouldn't talk to anybody. He just let the crazy talk, you know, grow inside of his head. And it resulted in his enemies capitalizing on his that crazy shit to the point that he made a big mess, including killing his friend, his wife, and himself. So like that's history is moved by individuals, right? Who are animated by very evil ideas or very, very good natural law oriented ideas. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see those people, even when they don't necessarily survive. It's beautiful to see the type of courage that you know, the Braveheart, what's his name? William Wallace.
William Wallace, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Like that makes you cry tears of joy, even though it's something bad that happened to William Wallace, this amazing man in Scotland, fighting the British, and yelling freedom, right, as he's being tortured. But it's history could be so much better than what we're given, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I also met Adam Riva, who did the new Badlands documentary, which you probably haven't seen it yet, but it comes out on May 1st. It'll be out in a week. For free. Dude, it's awesome. I mean, it's for like the normie audience. It's not really for people like you might already be aware of a lot of the stuff that happened in it. But man, it is a great like red pill thing to send to people. And Adam's a great storyteller. And I was kind of talking to him a little bit about potentially maybe doing some stuff where I know he has other ideas he's working on with John, but it'd be cool to get together with him and work on some history stuff. Because he was talking to me at dinner about how he's been doing these little like character pieces on individual characters. Like he did one on Joseph McCarthy. He did one he's doing one on Andrew Breitbart right now. I forget who the other two were that he mentioned, but he described it. He's like, it's like a statue, but a documentary. Instead of building up a statue, it's like you do a documentary, yeah. Something that people can circulate and appreciate. And it'd be cool to do that for like episodes of history or specific people who haven't really gotten a fair shake or people just don't really know about them and just tell it in a really compelling manner. So, So Roger 5x5, $5, ghosts, Huns settled in Hungary like Turks settled in Turkey. Both groups were originally from further east. Hungarians have two chronicles saying they invaded Roman Empire twice, once under Attila. And then he has a second, a $5 rant, once under his descendant, five generations later, in conjunction with Persian fleet besieging Constantinople. Our histories say Huns invaded 450 years after Attila and Khazars were in between with the Persian fleet. And yeah, you're right. Like I showed you the map of the steppe, and you know, like the steppe are kind of carved up into these little sections. So the Huns were actually from that Pannonian steppe, which is like the Ukrainian-Russian steppe. So they weren't quite as like the Mongols were from like East Asia, whereas the Huns weren't quite from East Asia. They were more like they were still Turkic. They're still considered Turkic, but it's not quite as far east as the Mongols are. The Mongols came later, like 500, 600 years later after the Huns. And by that, I mean, that's when they come into Eastern Europe. So then the next rant for Roger 5x5, I think he's continuing, $5, Hungarian chronicles make more sense, circa 1000 AD, emperor, pope, and Saxon king, then crowned Holy Roman Emperor, needed Hungary to convert to Christianity, not Islam, to defend East against Muslims. I don't know if you have a take on that, but, that's interesting. There are, like the origins of Russia and the Rus people are rooted in the Mongol invasion around that time, around 1000 AD. That was just after the Rus had converted to Christianity in 988. So it's not quite what you say, because the Russian people were already Christian in 1000 AD. So the Hungarians were already surrounded by Christians. But you're right. The Hungarians didn't convert until later. It was the Russians who converted, and the Rus converted because the Greeks came up through Constantinople, into Crimea, set up colonies in Crimea. And that's where, Vladimir the Great was converted in 988. And Putin talked about that. He kind of glossed over it. He should have been more, I think he should have lingered on that a little more, because he kind of missed the opportunity to say Vladimir got converted in Crimea in 988. And then he goes home to Kiev, which is where the capital of the Rus was, like the capital of basically proto-Russia. And he converts his family, I think we talked about that before, but so it's like Kiev and Crimea are like a central part. They play a very, very important role in the Christian Russia. Roger, $5 by $5, $5. Emperor, Pope, and Saxons invented Khazar invasion to take blame off of Huns for allying with Persians, because that Persian war led to temporary collapse of Eastern Empire in Persia, and consequently, and then one more rant from Roger, Rise of Islam. It's easier to get Huns to join your side against Muslims if you're not blaming their ancestors for creating the Frankenstein monster of the, in the first place. Many waves of steppe Asians, one more rant, came west and east starting around beginning of Iron Age, when Persians first bred horses large enough to carry a man, and especially after first century AD. All very interesting history. Very interesting history. And there could be truth to that. But yeah. Yeah, like I said, the Russians converted to Islam just before the Mongols really showed up. I mean, not Islam. The Russians converted to Christianity just before the Mongols really showed up. So,
yeah,
and that was a really important moment. They did like interbreed with the Mongols to a certain extent. Let's see. Trumpet, $20. This show is a delicious treat. Thanks again. Well, thank you, Trumpet. Roger, $5 by $5, $2. Swift's a modest proposal. Concealed red pill on child sacrifice. A modest proposal. I'm not as familiar with that.
Oh, that's golden. Yeah, it's short. You'll enjoy it if you're looking for something to read before bed. It's like 3 or 4 pages, short, tiny pamphlet on suggestions on how to eat babies.
Really
hilarious biting satire. Very good stuff. Yeah, and like, what else to do? What else to do with the baby after, you know, because we're overpopulated, so we have to deal with overpopulation. Why not, you know, deal also with food crisis at the same time? And that's what he goes through. He's like, let's just take this to its logical conclusion and see where this goes. And he comes up with recipes.
when was that written?
Must have been like 1713 or so, or 1714-ish.
Interesting. Yeah. There's a lot of Renaissance paintings that talk about like child sacrifice and child, like children being eaten by Satan and by other people.
Expose it or glorify it?
No, I think they're like, they're presenting the people eating the babies as like demons.
Okay. Well, the Goya does that. I know with his Saturn eating his children, painting that's also done around, well, that's a little bit later. That's 1801 or something. But anyway, yeah, the Goya paintings are disturbing in the later years when Spain is really going into hell. Cause earlier on Spain had a pro Republican king, who once he was ousted, it was a complete takeover of the Satanists, and Goya was a good guy, but he was like trying to just, at a certain point, the art has to, when things get really bad, you can't use pretty art anymore. It's like Machiavelli, you know, like you can't use pretty flowery language as a prince. If things are that bad, you have to go to the next level of street fighting at this point. And the same thing for the painting, where you see like a baby just getting munched on by Saturn, which does represent what the oligarchy does to themselves ultimately, and what they do practically and metaphorically. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. All right. Astro Emmy, $17. Slavery is a sad reality of human history based on human insecurity, where certain classes and ethnicities had to feel superior to others. Yes, that's true. And it's something that's been a part of human history since the very beginning. Rosalinda, $10. Make history sexy t-shirts for breaking history. That's a great idea. I think Kate did say that eventually we're gonna have merchandise for all the shows. So I will have to run that one by her. I'm sure that'll find its way. So thank you for the idea.
That's a great idea, actually. I could see that taking off. That's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, like make history sexy. I think it's a great idea. I think that's all the rants, but we do have a few boosts, it looks like. So if you go to badlandsmedia.tv, on the right, it says support Badlands. If you click on that and then you go to boosts, you can create a boost for any show, and they're cataloged on our website permanently, I think, for all time. As far as I know, they don't ever get deleted. But let's see. So I got to find the ones after last week's show, which would have been on the, looks like we have one on the 18th from Jake, $50. Breaking History is probably the most impactful and important series exposing the nature of the current world order and how it came to how it came about, as well as the new order planned by the same actors who accomplished the existing order, exposing the nefarious actors behind the naked colonialism disguised as globalism and other more humanistic terms designed to conceal its true nature, is of the utmost importance if people are to free themselves and others of this oppressive parasite. Very well said, Jake. And I think it's important to cultivate a curiosity in history, like Roger Five by Five coming at us with all that great knowledge. I think it's awesome when we can have these dialogues and these exchanges and bring facts and present ideas to one another that we haven't considered before. That's really how we sharpen, like iron sharpening iron, and creating our best understanding of history. It doesn't mean we're going to be perfect. Doesn't mean we're going to know everything, but we can try our best. Joseph Fawcett, $1. Sorry, guys. I would have loved to have given $100, but I'm broke at the moment. Guys, please dig deeper into your research, because you're getting things wrong. Gordon, you are missing so much info about Israel and their spiritual relationship with those that are around them. Plus, you lack understanding of what Yahweh is doing in this day between them. You seem to get your info about what is going on from what Hamas is putting out. Matt, I'm starting to doubt your knowledge. I know you have facts about St. Francis totally wrong. He had his calling in a church, not a cave. Please do more research. Well, Joseph, we certainly appreciate your support. And please, any support you can give us is fantastic. But, yeah, you know, if you're broke,
He did have his calling in a church advised by Franciscan friars, and it was a Benedictine church. But then he spent a lot of time in his sacred prayers in his cave, having his sacred experiences and what have you, in a very similar fashion as Saint Benedict had also experienced in these sacred caves. And no, I think that thank you for your honest criticism, but appreciate that.
Yeah. And as far as the comment about Hamas, I mean, you should go read the brief of what I've been putting in the brief the past couple of days, because I was actually laughing at Hamas because they basically have been the bag holder now. They're the only ones who basically are calling for war, except for a few warmongers in Israel. But you have people in Israel and Iran who are, it seems to me, working together to try to thwart these psychopaths everywhere who are trying to create a nuclear war or a World War III. Hamas is, I think, a creation of some really bad people in Israel who want to see Israel destroyed in order to foment World War III. So I understand what you're saying about the biblical relationship of Israel to God. I personally wonder whether we should call the modern nation of Israel canon until this is all over, because I think people get the name Israel. They hear the name Israel and they're like, oh, well, this must be the Israel from the Bible. No, it's a colony that was created by the Rothschilds in 1947, 1948. And they were astutely called it Israel because then they could convince lots and lots of Christians throughout the West to support it blindly. When really in reality, I think we're seeing some pretty awful things coming out of there, including right now battalions in the IDF being sanctioned with the exact same sanctions that Donald Trump issued against the Azov battalion for similar behaviors, human rights violations, torture, immoral misconduct, breaking basically like every like international law there is in terms of like war crimes, which is true. Like the IDF has been doing that for a while. It goes way beyond October 7th. And I'm sorry if that's triggering for people who hear it. We have lots and lots of testimony from actual IDF veterans who came out and said that this is happening. We have former heads of the Shin Bet, former heads of IDF leaders who have come out and said this stuff. So this isn't like, you know, my own conspiracy theory. This is actual testimony coming out of people who served in the IDF who are saying this stuff was going on, and they basically are struggling to live with themselves because of what they feel like they were a part of. And there's some real scumbags in the IDF, and that's a consequence of forcing every single person. I mean, imagine if we forced every single 18-year-old in America to serve in the armed forces for 2 years. Imagine how many scumbags there would be in the military. So, I mean, that's a product of forced conscription of every 18-year-old is you're going to get some scumbags in there, and it is what it is. So, But yeah, thank you for the rant. Yeah, we will try to do better, I guess. But that's it. So that is the show. I think next week we're going to do the Jesuits. Cynthia will be joining us for that.
Yep. We're going to pick up on the what came before, during, after the Jesuits. What are they? We alluded to the Council of Trent, and specifically Venice and co-creating the Anglican and Jesuit synthetic, you know, groupings at the same year, you know, by similar agents, as well as this is the same time that Malta is being set up, right? The Knights of St. John of Jerusalem is being set up in Malta, set 1530, same time, you know, reconfiguring that whole weird architecture. So we're going to, Cynthia's going to join us. We'll have a good chat. And I would just add one thing for those who want to dig on Rumble, in the comments section, I put a couple of links to some resources people can pick up. One of them is to the Anglo-Venetian Roots of the Deep State. It's my volume 4 of The Clash of the Two Americas. Goes into elements of what was touched on today. In some cases, that goes further. And the other one is How the Nation Was Won, Graham Lowry. People are listening and they want to if you're only going to buy one book this week, make it How the Nation Was Won by Graham Lowry. Whatever you got to pay it. It's worth it. It's, I think, available free on archive.org too, if you need to get a PDF. So that's it. Gordon, it was great as always. Thank you everybody for listening, and see y'all next week.
See y'all.